Hello, and welcome to The Brief, a video podcast that looks at global news events and brings you perspective and analysis. I'm your host, Jim Clancy. As always, we appreciate a like or a follow, and you can find links to more of our episodes at thebriefpodcast.org. Well, Trump 2.0 has arrived, preceded by a year of warnings about the sad state of affairs in the United States and the promise of a legendary self-promoter who says only he can fix them. And not only the problems at home, but also around the globe. The Gulf of Mexico, of course, has been holding us back. Our guest on this edition of The Brief Podcast is New York Times columnist Nicholas Kristof. Nick has a way of assessing the facts and finding some silver linings in the world that we live in today. He's also got perspectives on some of our most vexing challenges. Hello, Nick, and welcome to The Brief.
Great to be with you.
You know, this is the time of year, and I always look forward to your columns about it, when we reassess where we are in the world, and there's been so much negativity this year. I mean, for good reason. There have been a lot of really horrifying stories out there, and we've got President Trump has added to some of the gloom here in the United States.
He sure has.
Really, let's look on the bright side for a minute, if we can, Nick.
Yeah, well, you know, normally I do that column around January 1st, looking at the bright side. And this year, I just didn't have the heart to do it. But people began asking about it. They felt like in need of it. And I realized that I was in need of it as well. And so I weighed the situation. And yeah, all the grim realities are absolutely true. And I worry about where things are going to go. And I'm disheartened by wars in Gaza and Sudan and Ukraine. But it's also true that the risk of a child dying is lower in, or was lower in 2024 than at any point in human history. You know, 3.6%, that fewer people were living in extreme poverty last year than at any time in human history. And those are pretty real accomplishments. There are advances in science on malaria and breast cancer, schizophrenia. And so I just think, look, we in journalism, we inflict bad news on people every other day of the year. There should be one moment where we offer a little bit of uplift and a reminder, a context, a perspective that there are still some things going right, kind of as motivation to keep on fighting the good fight.
Well, we all needed it this year for sure. I want to look a little more closely at what is described by some as Trump 2.0. He has swept into office with a flurry of executive orders and really shaking things up.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a mild way even of putting it. There was a strong sense, as you know, in his first term that his extremism was tempered by a certain amount of incompetence. And there was a lot less incompetence this time around. He was ready. He knew what to do. He hired people who didn't just look like they were from central casting, but actually kind of knew what they were doing and knew the toolbox in the federal government. And
Planned, and he's had the support to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, one of the things that particularly troubled me was the mass clemency, the pardons and the release of every single person prosecuted for January 6th. I think because you and I, in both in our careers, we've seen how societies can unravel, and political violence is one element of that. And I fear that Trump was incentivizing more political violence, more domestic terrorism, by sending a signal that people who follow him and engage in violence won't face consequences. They will enjoy impunity. So I worry about that. We're already seeing some of those people freed, talking about taking vengeance on people in government. I worry about that. I worry about public health, RFK Jr. and his suspicion of vaccines, the U.S. pulling out of the World Health Organization. I worry about what's going to happen with the military. Instead of preparing for some real security risks worldwide, being drawn into culture wars, being sent to the border, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of reason to be deeply concerned about the directions for the next 4 years.
Well, Trump has set his followers and all the rest of us up with this, and he just pounded it into people that America was failing, that things were going bad, that the economy was a disaster, and only one man could fix it. Only one man had the vision and the power to do it, and he's risen up with this imperial thing. And we all know the people, the guy at work that says, you know, this is a terrible problem, and yeah, I'm the guy to solve it. Well, of course you are, because you're the one that made it.
Yeah, you know, my take is that Trump is actually very good at diagnosing problems or things that don't fit well. I mean, he was so good at coming up with nicknames for other Republican rivals, for example. He just sort of sensed that weakness and went in for the kill. And he was really good at that. And I think likewise, he's been very good at identifying problems, maybe those that are uncomfortable to talk about or that, you know, we liberals kind of paper over, and, you know, in ways that resonate with a lot of the American people. I think while he is sometimes good at identifying those problems, diagnosing those problems, he's awful at the solution side and often takes steps that make things worse.
This is really immigration. You raised that issue. George W. Bush, almost 20 years ago. So what we need is a system where we can allow workers in, give them permits to work and come in and put an immigration policy to work. They want to come here, they want to earn money, but they want to go home too. And he tried to advance that. The Republican Party said, oh, no, don't do that. Well, the result has been over the years, we don't have a real immigration policy. And it's instant gratification to see vans pull up and all these brown people are herded into the vans and hauled to the border. For some of his supporters, that's instant gratification. The law is being followed, but it's not a solution.
That's right. I mean, my take is that in his first term, Trump pushed me, and I think many people like me, to the left. And we became, you know, once we saw families separated at the border, we became instinctively very pro-immigration in a way that wasn't nuanced in us. And I do think that the Biden administration was, for the first part of its term, probably too lax on immigration in ways that really did antagonize a lot of people and help cost the election. But, you know, the idea of now Trump, you know, potentially devastating the economy by shipping out millions and millions of people. I mean, they're, you know, it's complicated. The American economy depends upon people who are undocumented. And yet also we now have about 15% of the population that is foreign born, which is, is roughly the highest level since 1850 and is higher than a lot of Americans want. And, you know, we should be able to, it's not a binary choice. It's not an on-off switch. It's an adjustment. And I don't think that, Biden, to his credit, last June really took steps that largely solved the problem. And now, you know, Trump is going to come in and talks about mass deportations, and, you know, there are so many families where you have parents who may be undocumented and a child who is an American citizen, and you're effectively trying to deport American citizens. I don't think that they appreciate the complexity and messiness and brutality in many cases of what they're doing.
Well, that's because families are living in terror. Some of them, because they fear that, yes, dad will be sent away. Then what do we do? Do we go with him? Do we stay here? Is he all alone? Are we all alone? All of these kinds of issues still have to be resolved. And these kinds of, I don't know, you want to call it grandstanding, and these, you know, sweeping, I can solve this problem, here we go, we just throw them out. It doesn't solve the real problems, which, as you say, have to balance the economy of the United States, the needs of farmers, the needs of meatpacking industries, things like this, with the concerns of the citizenry that too many people are coming in for the wrong reasons.
Absolutely. I mean, we benefit from immigration, and yet it is also true that we can't take every person around the globe. And we have to calibrate that. And Democrats haven't always done that right. But boy, the Trump administration sure seems prepared to do it wrong as well.
There's another aspect to this Trump administration coming in that troubles me. And maybe, yeah, you tell me, am I overstating this? But, you know, the Bibles, the watches. Now that, what is it, meme coins that he and Melania have? I mean, a better Ponzi scheme. Run from the white. What are we doing here?
Yeah, it is kind of astonishing how Trump also just surrounded himself, you know, with crooks. I mean, people like Paul Manafort, and there were just an army of them. And then, you know, the Trump family itself looking for every way to monetize the White House. And I mean, that is distasteful enough, but in some cases, it really seems tied to influence peddling. I worry about these new crypto meme coins, that they can be used by foreigners effectively to increase Trump's wealth. You know, if I were from foreign country, try to win Trump's favor, I would buy a ton of them. That immediately means that, you know, his wealth goes up dramatically. You know, his reversal
TikTok.
And
it turned into a business deal.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, it's sort of troubling when he's against TikTok and thinks that a sale should be forced, and even issues an executive order along those lines. And then he meets with a billionaire who's a major investor in the parent company of TikTok, Edward Yes. And then he announces, well, actually, it's not so bad. And then, you know, lately that we're going to make a deal to keep TikTok in the U.S. That
well, you were a correspondent and bureau chief for the New York Times in China. And you wrote about it. You outlined what are the risks here, because most Americans, I have a DJI drone, and yeah, I go over the golf course. So what? Mostly, it's looking at my gutter's full of leaves, but actually, there's a lot of data that can come from that, and it does go back to China.
Yeah, I think that with TikTok, there are two principal risks. And one is the one that I think worries me the most is the data collection. We don't know exactly what data goes back, but it seems that there's a huge amount of it. And that includes exact locations, that includes full access to contacts, including, you know, some people keep their passwords in contacts. And so any Chinese company is legally obliged to share information with state security if asked. Of course, state security is going to ask for the TikTok accounts of, you know, the children of Secretary of State Marco Rubio, for example, children of other officials. It's going to try to use those phones as microphones, as cameras. And, you know, that's not exactly evil. It's just what governments do. We try to spy on China. It's going to try to spy on us. And if we allow TikTok to continue, that is giving it a window into the phones of 170 million Americans. It's an incredibly valuable tool to give a country with which, God forbid, we may end up at some point in a war.
It is troubling. There's no doubt about that. And internationally, President Trump is obviously viewed as this transactional president. In fact, I think the word is out, whether you're in the Middle East, in the Gulf, or in East Asia, no matter where you are, flatter him. If you want to win favor, as he talks about tariffs, everybody's concerned, as well they should be, but flatter him, because he apparently doesn't see that in his own mirror. He loves that flattery, and it does build relationships.
Yeah, I think everybody has learned how to manipulate him in that regard. And, you know, of course, I worry about Ukraine, what it's going to mean there. I worry about what it's going to mean in the Far East. You know, I think the single thing nightmare I have that is the greatest is a war with China. And the Biden administration, to its credit, did a very good job of knitting together East Asia with alliances, Philippines, Australia, South Korea, Japan, that I think deters China, I think reduces the risk of that kind of conflagration. And then, of course, the Middle East. And I mean, I think the Biden administration completely failed in the Middle East. I think it's been a catastrophe what has unfolded in Gaza and to some degree and in the West Bank. And, you know, what happens if Israel decides to annex the West Bank? And we have now an ambassador to the UN and a ambassador to Israel who both think that, the West Bank is Israel's. You know, do we then deny Palestinians democratic rights? Do we expel them? I'm just
there's a certain
worried.
Arrogance that Trump's policies exude, and that is that somehow we as Americans have the right to decide what we do with the Palestinians' territory.
And with Greenland,
how does the U.S. greenlight taking somebody else's property? And upending years and years of, not a successful, but at least a sustaining situation. Let's turn to Gaza, because I think there the U.S. has suffered terrible setbacks in terms of its image around the world. Every successive president, we're the greatest country in the world. We are the ones that are hold up the lamp for human rights. As the arms shipments continued through the devastation of Gaza, that was, that notion was just completely eroded.
Yeah, I mean, the whole basis for our international efforts to support Ukraine were that we have to support international rules-based order. And that was completely undermined by our posture in the Middle East. We supplied weapons to Ukraine with restrictions on how they could be used. We did not impose any meaningful restrictions on how weapons supplied to Israel could be used. And we ended up underwriting, the killing of many tens of thousands of children in Gaza with weapons used in ways that American troops would not be able to use them. This was then accompanied by rampages of settlers in the West Bank, et cetera, by, the Biden administration. The one time it really seemed to try to impose accountability was not on Israel. It was on UNRWA, the UN agency providing support for Palestinians. And now it is possible that UNRWA is going to be completely booted out of
With no replacement.
It is the pillar of humanitarian efforts and of development in the Palestinian territories. And the Biden administration bears some responsibility for setting that in motion. And I think the Trump administration will be worse on that account.
October 7th was a devastating episode. Horrifying. War crimes committed before our eyes, civilians slaughtered in the streets, Hamas had to be held to account. But this notion that you're going to destroy Hamas by, just obliterating the living place of more than 2 million Palestinians, it didn't work. Hamas was still standing there in their bandanas and with their bandoliers as the very first Israeli hostages were freed.
That's right. So much death and destruction. And for what? Hamas, as you say, is still in control. The hostages still have not been freed. Meanwhile, more than 3,000 children under the age of 5 have been killed in Gaza. Kids starved to death. They've frozen to death. It's just heartbreaking how little it has achieved. And, we shouldn't need to look. I don't think that there is a moral equivalence between Hamas and Israel. I reported in Gaza. I've seen how repressive and brutal, homophobic, misogynistic Hamas can be. But I do absolutely think that there is a moral equivalence between a Palestinian child and an Israeli child and an American child. And we completely forgot that moral equivalence. One shouldn't have to remind people in 2025 that Palestinians are humans too and deserving our recognition of their shared humanity. And I don't think that the war in Gaza was waged in ways that respect that shared humanity.
In the process, I think the state of Israel has lost a huge amount. And yes, the suffering, the hostages still held by Hamas in Gaza. That is a crisis. But there's another crisis, and that is people expect impunity for the way that this war was waged. And they have said, we're going to apply this formula, which was really a scorched earth policy in Gaza, where, you know, to make it uninhabitable. Those words, those are the exact words were used by, I think it was Smotrich, one of the most extreme right-wing members of the cabinet of Prime Minister Netanyahu, as he describes, we're going to transfer this to the West Bank. And we're encouraging that. Our silence is encouraging that.
That's right. I thought that Biden was way too weak on the West Bank as well as on Gaza, but he did impose sanctions on some settlers, and now Trump has lifted those sanctions. Again, that just conveys impunity.
Well, the impunity is the problem because no one is held accountable. And President Trump isn't exactly an expert on accountability. Maybe he's an expert on evading accountability.
That's right. That's right. And you know, you saw that now there's an effort in the Pentagon to eliminate the office that was responsible for avoiding war crimes.
Well, and here's the problem. The U.S. is being dragged down with Israel, its strongest ally. It would appear as troops were added in Syria that the U.S. was fully aware. They doubled their troop strength 2 weeks before Bashar al-Assad was overthrown. Clearly had an indication of what was afoot. I mean, I think that it had to have been well known. And the U.S., perhaps that's why I don't know for sure. That's why the Biden administration kept sending more and more arms to Israel. But they have been so misused.
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that Israel is in a very dangerous neighborhood and that it, you know, the Biden administration tended to justify the shipment of weapons by noting correctly that Israel is potentially vulnerable to attacks from Hezbollah, from the Houthis, from Iran. But that gives us leverage precisely because Israel needs those weapons. Then we should be able to impose the kind of restrictions that we did on Ukraine and that we impose on our own soldiers, for example. And, you know, that unfortunately, that did not happen.
So many people today are focused on, you know, what do we do about impunity? What do we do about Israel? What do we do about the war crimes? How about going to the ICC and all of these things? And so little is really focused on how do we help the Palestinians to build a credible government of their own, because this one, the Palestinian Authority, is completely discredited.
What do you know, so I tend to think that one of the, you know, I completely agree the Palestinian Authority is a mess. It doesn't have any legitimacy with Palestinians. I look around the terrain and I see Marwan Barghouti as one of the few people who I can imagine could actually lead Palestinians and make the difficult concessions that could lead to a Palestinian state. And of course, Marwan Barghouti is in prison serving a life sentence for murder of Israelis. It would be, I think, a very difficult thing for Israel politically to release him. And yet, some Israeli security experts have said.
There's precedent on the Israeli side for former terrorists, people who appeared on wanted posters under the British mandate, wanted for terrorism, becoming prime minister.
That's
right. One of the most outstanding was Ariel Sharon. And Ariel Sharon is one of the people that really pushed this notion that you divide the Palestinians, you give Hamas Gaza, let the PA have the West Bank, and then you say, I have nobody to negotiate with. Who am I going to negotiate with? There's no unity here.
Right.
How do we push that? How do we provide something for the Palestinians to build that unity? I know they're meeting. I know they're talking about this subject.
So, I mean, that's one of the reasons I emphasize the importance of international pressure to release Marwan Barghouti. I don't know if he would emerge as a Palestinian leader. I don't know if he'd be able to negotiate in ways that would achieve a peace, but I have a hard time seeing who else could do that. And so I would love to see, and you know, it shouldn't happen as a result of Hamas demands. That makes Hamas a hero. That shouldn't happen. But I do think that a path to peace may, would be helped if Barghouti were released. And beyond that, there are some amazing Palestinians out there pursuing peaceful means. Issa Amro in Hebron, sometimes called the Palestinian Gandhi, incredibly courageous. There are others, but they tend not to get attention. And, we in the media, we tend to pounce on the violence and not on the peacemakers.
The controversies always sell in journalism. The state of journalism today, you're still deeply involved. But I had spoken with you a little bit earlier about how I talked with some journalists in the Caribbean, and they're completely disillusioned. They do not believe, as I think you and I do, that journalism, you can change the world with your writing, with your reporting. They don't hold that anymore.
So I think it's true that journalism faces some real challenges. The business model is collapsing for a lot of journalism. 2.5 newspapers are going out a week, going out of business every week around the country. And trust in journalism, as in most institutions, has been collapsing as well. So, there are real headwinds that we face, but think of journalism as a guardrail. And look, guardrails are imperfect and people drive through them, they crash through them, but they are an institution that does provide scrutiny, that does provide accountability, that makes things somewhat better. And I think that is that has to be the aim of journalists, that we don't just aim for page views, but we also do. I mean, I think most of us went into journalism because we did think that there is a public good there, that we can do something beneficial. And I think readers and our audiences should hold us accountable for that as well, that if we ask for special privileges of access, then we should be held accountable.
I look at it all and see the changes that have come about, particularly in the television news industry, the 24-hour model that I come from at CNN. And, it changed. It fundamentally changed when it became corporate ownership of the media, because the corporate ownership is not focused on what do we need to tell the audience, what facts are important for them to understand, what issues can we explore to illuminate this. Even when there's strife, we could illuminate this perhaps and turn down the temperature instead. I remember the morning meetings. All right, what's leading on social media today? Let's give the 16-year-olds what they want because we need that younger audience. It's about profits. The goal is profits, and it is not to inform the public. Your thoughts?
I still think that what the media do is incredibly important, and that, you and I, we both know journalists who take risks to go cover these important stories, even as the budget masters don't necessarily prioritize those things. And when I see, journalists going off to try to cover the famine in Sudan, the civil war in Myanmar, I'm just, there is still some extraordinarily good work in journalism. And, you have to believe that it does make a difference. Otherwise, you don't take those risks. And I think it, and I truly do think it does make a difference. Not enough, but it's sure better than not having that coverage at all.
I would have to agree with you there. I think every journalist would. You have a little program where you sponsor journals. You run a bit of a contest, an essay contest, and then take them out. And you warn them. As you get older, just for the audience, as you get older as a journalist, a lot of times the producer says, go off and do this. And when you're older, your first question is, tell me, boss, is this going to be a camping trip?
That's right. Yeah, the joke in the New York Times is that first prize is a trip with me. Second prize is two trips with me. you can relate, I'm sure. This started my Win a Trip journey. It started when I was trying to get more attention to Darfur. And I thought, how do I get students to care about Darfur? Oh, well, I have this contest to take a student with me on a reporting trip to cover the Darfur genocide. And the New York Times lawyers said, oh, so you want to take a student into a war zone. So then I had to recalibrate and made it a reporting trip to cover neglected issues worldwide. And so the first one was in 2006. I just took my most recent student to Kenya, Madagascar, and Mauritius, covering nutrition and health issues. And the contest is now open. If you know any university student who is interested in journalism and in the world, then they should go to nytimes.com/winatrip. And there's information and an application due at the end of this month.
The whole concept behind that, to me, is fascinating because, and I'm sure you've met, you know, younger journalists today. I have met journalists that are really good, but had never done an interview in person. Yeah. It had always been across the screen. And I was thinking, how do you even do your job? I mean, because you have to be able to read people. There's so much nuance and subtlety in interviewing and what you get out of it and judging, you know, because what someone says is ultimately less important than why they said it.
Yeah, and so much, you know, there's so many folks who don't actually call somebody, either writing about some issue, and they don't call them up, and they just, you know, read statements and go online. And, you know, before I
saw it on the internet.
Yeah, exactly. Before I criticize somebody, I always call them up and say, look, I'm going to take a whack at you. You know, here's the way I see it. And, you know, you give them a chance to respond. And sometimes you learn things that, you know, that change your view. And likewise, you know, especially maybe when I lived in China, and then when I was in the run-up to the Iraq War, when I was in Iraq, I saw how in Washington you can get these echo chambers where everybody convinces each other of something, and they really don't understand the country, they don't understand what's going on, and it can be really dangerous for American foreign policy. So I think it's so important to get out there, get out of the Capitol, talk to people who, you know, who don't speak English, didn't go to university, you know, aren't the foreign minister or a taxi driver.
Right. Well, I often consider the taxi driver on the trip in from the airport to be my first interview, first important interview, you know, to figure out what is going on someplace. But that kind of interaction, and you're right, people, you know, they get it all off the internet. They end up talking to themselves and they confirm what they set out to prove because they didn't look any further. I like to tell the journalists, young journalists that I meet and ask me that, you know, if you do an investigation or if you do something and you've got this, you've proved what your point, your hypothesis has been proven, throw it away. It's no good. If you didn't learn anything, that means you didn't look very hard. It really is a way of judging our work. And I think that your program gives them an opportunity to do that because I'm sure you push them.
Yeah, and I think that they, you know, they learn, well, when we were in Madagascar this time, the, you know, we asked officials about child marriage, whether climate change and drought and famine or hunger were leading people to marry young, to marry off their daughters. And everybody said, no, you know, impossible. We've instituted a minimum marriage age of 18. That doesn't happen. And so we're taken to a village, and indeed, things are kind of fine there. Then we go off. We ask there, well, what other villages around here are in difficulties? We go off to the next one, and there are kids who are starving, getting no assistance, and people are talking about a 14-year-old girl who was just married off because her family didn't have enough food to feed her. And so I do think it's so important to get out, to test limits, to keep on going, to ask questions. The problem is that the business model for that kind of journalism is quite uncertain. And if, you know, when I in my memoir, Chasing Hope, I write about how I did, some Yemen trips covering what was then the world's worst humanitarian crisis. And I happened to do back-to-back a Yemen column and a Brett Kavanaugh column when he was up for confirmation. And the Brett Kavanaugh column got, I think it was 7 times as many page views, you know, for a piece I wrote at my desk in a few hours, compared to Yemen, which was expensive, was dangerous. And so you can see why editors and executive producers don't want to send people off to Yemen on a trip when the upshot is that audiences will switch channel or move on to something else. But on the other hand, you know, that is what we do. We don't just crave page views and numbers. We try to present a picture of the world. And we have to find a balance there where we have a business model but can also cover things that are truly important.
You have to tell a compelling story, because the real task, and you bring it up there, is that we have to convince the American public that international, what's going on in their world, is important to them, that understanding their world and the people that are in it is important. I think there's a lot in the immigration crisis that people don't understand about what's going on in Central America. Biden administration, Kamala Harris went down to Central America, and then we never heard any more about it. But there's where the heart of some of the problems are that are forcing all these people to come up. And this talk about, well, we're going to go after one of the gangs they're going after. What, you mean the one that was started in
that
L.A.?
That we started.
Prisons? That, you know, they did it on our backs. And then we exported it down to them. There's a lot of crazy things that are going on. What is the, as you chased hope around, I want to just stress your book that came out last year. What's your fondest memory of your career as a journalist, or the ones that stand out?
So, you know, I think maybe the most transformative for me was covering the Chinese democracy movement in 1989 as a young reporter. And I learned a lot from that. And one of the things I learned has to do with something I still feel kind of guilty about. During that democracy movement, I wrote regularly about how the Chinese workers and peasants, they say they're for democracy, but they can't really define the democracy that they're for. And, you know, they don't really know what they want to create. And that was true. It was a little snide, but it was true. But then that terrible night of June 4th, 1989, when the People's Liberation Army opened fire on those workers and those peasants and those students and that crowd that I was in, the bravest people were these uneducated peasants from the countryside. And, you know, these rickshaw drivers who rode toward the gunfire to pick up the bodies of kids who'd been killed, to rush them to the hospitals. And there was a bus driver who was, he was on the old airport road, and there was a convoy of trucks coming in to crush the students. And he put his bus across the road to block the trucks of soldiers. And a officer came over and ordered him to move the bus, and he refused. And then this bus driver, the salt of the earth bus driver, he hurled his keys to the bus into the high grass in the verge by the side of the road, and, you know, so that they couldn't move it. And, you know, here's a guy, he might not have been able to define democracy, but he was ready to die for it. And I think that those Chinese I saw at that time, that they, precisely because they lived under a dictatorship, appreciated more than we in this country do the value of democracy, the importance of those guardrails, those institutions. I think there's a lot that we in this country can learn from the kind of courage that I saw at Tiananmen in 1989.
Nick Kristof, thank you for being who you are, being a journalist who cares and can identify what the problems are and still be looking for solutions.
Thank you, Jim. It's been a real pleasure.
And thank you for joining us. Please explore many of our other episodes of The Brief Podcast. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Give us a like or subscribe. For a complete listing, you can find more information at thebriefpodcast.org. For now, I'm Jim Clancy, and you've been briefed.